Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome back to part two of My Time Capsule. With me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Danny Baker. Now, if you've already listened to part one, you'll know that when you left us, Danny and I were heading towards Niagara Falls in a small boat, and the engine had failed. Or something equally exciting. So let's find out what happens next, or at least the rest of the things that Danny wants to put in his time capsule. See you on the other side.
And we're back.
Welcome to part two.
Exactly. So there it is.
Brilliant. Danny, I looked up the Book of Nonsense.
Yes.
Edited by R.L. Green. That's what you said, isn't it?
That's it, yes. Yeah.
I looked it up. I couldn't find it. Do you know what I did find? And I thought you might be interested in it. If you like it, I'm going to buy it for you. It's called The Tales of Make-Believe. Edited by R.L. Green.
No.
And it's illustrated by Harry Tootle.
Oh, dear old Tootle. Some say Tuttle. Or is that Tootle Tuttle? I don't know. But that's actually one I'm talking about. And it's fairly common around. It's got this some beautiful, beautiful colour plates in it. There's every single sort of character from Nonsense. Aged Uncle Ollie, the Walrus and the Carpenter. You can see the Jabberwocky, Straw Peter. You can see Owl and the Pussycat. Everyone is in there. And the beautiful, beautiful book, but there's nothing like the content. It's just every single thing you ever wanted to be mesmerised and made to feel wonder with.
Yeah, I was tempted to buy it. Well, I'm going to buy it for my grandchildren.
You must. Nobody I knew read that book. Nobody I knew got it.
No.
But if you do, you think, oh, it really is. It's like literal LSD. I mean, literal. All my life I've adored it. I picked it up. I think when I got my daughter's one, it was only about 15 quid, dust jacket and everything.
Yeah,
and she's a school teacher and she takes it to school. And whenever she just goes, throws that little dog leg, they find out that, you know, J.K. Rowling only hints at what you can make up. And certainly between, you know, in the 19th century, they were all over it, as you know.
Yeah.
But the little riddles and stuff at the end, this story, I don't remember this. Augustus, who would not eat any soup.
I do.
And gets as thin as that. I mean, that always absolutely terrifies kids. But take this nasty soup away. I won't have any soup today. Look at him. The fourth day's come. He scarcely weighs a sugar plum. He's like a little bit of thread. And on the fifth day, he was dead. Now, you know.
No holding back.
But, you know, that goes long before the word dark and all that. It's just like, yeah.
There you go.
I know.
That'll teach you.
Well, I hope you can source a copy, but it's certainly absolute wonders that spun me off into everything I do now.
Well, of course, we both know that you never know where that sort of inspiration for your life is going to come from. There's something that's going to push you down a path that nobody else is pushing you down.
Because when do you ever say to people, you know, I never planned this or whatever, that I tend to think that maybe most people are ruthless and warriors, but if you're not, And it does happen that way. And it's, yes, of course, it's extremely fortunate, but also you have to have a little bit of a gumption, as a word straight out of a primary school, usually a gumption. And you have to build of that. And it worked out extraordinarily well for me. I remember when I used to get asked to go to schools, and in my old school, although it's turned into flats, one of the first schools to be turned into flats, West Greenwich, which is top of Deptford High Street, but they called it West Greenwich, which I always thought was rather grand. they say, could you come back, you know, and tell people if they work hard and, you know, keep at it and keep trying? I always had to turn and say, I can't say that because I never have. Mine has been literally some kind of a pinball machine, the gods thought, let's see what happens to him. And straight from school to, you know, serving Elton John on my third day in the record shop, et cetera, et cetera, and on and on and on, yeah, through the punk rock gear, which happened by such Byzantine roots. And again, but people think you're just polishing up an otherwise cloak and dagger CV, but it isn't. I didn't have an agent until 1989. I've done television series, I've done everything, and it's just I kind of went skint around 1989. And then they said, have you ever thought about radio? And they were the first people to say that. And I said, not really. I don't, as I said yesterday, I don't listen to the radio. So, and that was completely fortuitous. Mm.
I think life is, though. I think people who pretend that they plan their life. The only person I've ever come across who told me the plan of his life and then did it was Patrick Marber, the writer.
Oh, yeah.
And when he was very young, he said, this is what we're going to do. This is what I'm going to do. And he basically followed exactly what he told me years ago.
I mean, you know, God bless Patrick Marber, but I would think that it would be kind of... That's a little antiseptic.
Yeah.
But to know what you're going to do, who would want that?
Yeah.
I mean, it certainly, my life, it would have been presumed. I had literally no idea. My old man was always very, very encouraging, not in terms of, you know, no one in my family did anything. When we were doing the Sniffing Glue fanzine, which, again, is preposterous. Kid, I was at school when Mark Perry started it, and when he was working in a bank, but my sister had a typewriter. So we followed that. But my old man said, how's the typing going, boy? Never writing, always typing.
Yeah.
And equally, when I said I wanted to leave school at 14, I was the brightest in a year at school, which wasn't that much of a boast when you consider the second brightest went on to be a roadie for Richie Blackmore's Rainbow. it was just a, you know, comprehensive at the top of Deptford High Street. I left there at 14. The last year you could leave at 14. I know, 14. Mm. Sounds Victorian, but you could. Yeah. 72 was the last year before it went up that summer to 15.
Yeah, I remember it happening. I remember kids being really annoyed because they wanted to go and work in their dad's garage.
There you go. People, Russell Anderson was the very first to leave. He didn't even wait for the Easter holidays, which is when I went, because I was booked in a record shop. But my old man said, it wasn't like that then. You know, you stay on, get a good job, nothing. Just get a job. As long as you put a fiver on the table on Friday night, he said, you can do what you want.
Yeah.
And don't sign, the biggest sin was signing on. And don't you sign on.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. He lived very much under the radar in every kind of way. Once they've got, it's not because he felt any particular shame in it. He just thought, once you've got a number, and they know who you are. That was his thinking. You go down there, and everybody will watch you to send you places, and he wouldn't have that. So I went straight from school into a record shop. But that was his philosophy. Was always, don't have a bank account, don't have anything, don't exist within any kind of framework. That was honestly, he was genuinely like that, and he was incredibly good with money for all of us.
Yeah,
knock it out. You're like me. Say, you're like me, boy. You're a forager. You'll always be able to get hold of a few quid.
Fantastic.
That's what he always told us. Yeah,
that's lovely. And, isn't it?
But they were tremendously encouraging, and not encouraging, he just did it.
Yeah,
I didn't encourage it to do anything. That's something I think that has been lost, but it certainly doesn't make sense to people now. Nobody ever had a career, like we just said there.
Mm.
The careers wasn't a word. You wouldn't got jobs, but such was the world then. If you didn't like that job, you got another job.
Yeah.
You know, and people say, oh, well, boomers, it was easy for you. But it actually wasn't. It was just this, I think, intentional emphasis that's put on work. And, you know, and then people have got no option now.
Yeah.
But that's not coincidental. But then I genuinely, to this day, and I still see my mates when I go to Millwall, I don't know what they used to do for a living. I genuinely don't.
No.
I don't know. You know, when you'll say this, is Bill still working at the, and I go, I don't know. It just wasn't the thing. You did a job and you come home and you went out.
Yeah. And he didn't talk about it.
No, and there was none of this working your way up a ladder or what I'll be doing in 5 years or what I plan to do.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a mundane and obvious thing. Oh, you go to work. There was no office work. I mean, nobody I never knew worked in offices, which is all you've got now. I mean, to be absolutely honest,
yeah.
We as you know, around in Bermondsey, there was factories everywhere. Mm. We mentioned pig frames and Shuttleworths.
And the docks.
And the docks. But there was Mullins, which made vending machines, Sarson's Vinegar, mm-hmm. The railway arches, which had nefarious businesses going on in all of them.
All sorts of things. My Uncle Bill, the old bloke who lived next door to us when we lived in Alderton Road, he worked in some sort of metal factory. That's all I remember. Yep. It was just down the road. He came back for lunch.
That was called the Metal Box Factory.
Ah, right, yeah.
That's what it was called, the Metal Box. I know Metal Box would be, I've got to start a Metal Box Saturday. Oh, yeah, yeah. And the Metal Box was a big employer, but that's all it was called, right. The Metal Box. You remind me, I've not thought about that for 50-odd years. But mates of mine would ever get a job on site, you know, pulling cable or something. But a lot of them would say, I'm doing 6 weeks at the Metal Box. Mm. Okay, and that was it. You didn't need to know anything more about what they did, they might tell you that individuals they worked with. But this idea of a career,
yeah.
And nobody in my family and nobody I knew owned a house. No. We all lived in flats. And as I said yesterday, and it was wonderful. It was terrific. Mm. This demonisation and kind of special pleading now on part of the council estates and people, they shrink from it when you say council estates, as if you're trying to prove something, yeah. You know. But the class thing we could get into, which is too big. And that was it. And I'm afraid if you look at it like that and a lot of people don this, you know, proletarian cloak, I'm impeccable. I did tweet last night, funny enough, because somebody was talking about it. To be working class, you can't inherit it from grandparents because they always say that. People used to patronise the hell out of me. Probably still do. Oh, my granddad was a miner.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I know, but you went to Cambridge, you know, which is fine. That's all good too. But they'll always try and it's almost like, you know, some of my best friends are black, you know, that kind of thing. They'll say that.
Yeah.
Oh, my uncle used to work in the markets. Okay, well, good for your uncle, you know.
Yes.
But you can't inherit working class. You cannot shed it.
No.
No matter what happens after that. People say to me, you live in a big house on Blackheath. I do. I do. And so would anyone, you know.
Any working class person had the money, yeah.
Yeah. The idea that, oh, no, you should stay down, you know, down in Deptford eating cockles, which actually is not a bad life. But that kind of thing, how dare you?
It's weird, isn't it?
How dare you? It's like meeting some of the good acts and saying, oh, I bet you've got a massive house in the country. And they say, no, I haven't. but if you're working class, and both of us, you more than me, have shed a natural accent. I hear old recordings of me, man alive. Mm. Oh, my God, I make Harry Fowler sound like Prince Charles. Harry Fowler reference, everyone.
Yes, people can Google.
And, you lose that, but you never lose. I mean, until I was 20, I lived in Debenhams Road, the flats, which is fine.
Yeah, my uncle, I used to walk across Southwark Park at 6 o'clock in the morning, having got the train from Orpington, and I'd help my uncle load his van. Climb over the gates, walk through the park in the dark.
People Bermondsey's. A lot of Bermondsey and Rotherhithe are built around Southwark Park.
Yeah.
And they still lock the gates of it.
Yes.
At random hours. And to walk around it, it's a long way. It's a real long circumnavigation down Jamaica Road and you know, up Lower Road, then down Rotherhithe. All the way around. Or you can get over the gates.
Over the gates, of course. That's what I did. But I used to go across, climb over the other gates, and then go and help my uncle load his van. And we would drive to East Street Market where he sold leather coats.
Did he?
Yeah.
Did he? No, East Lane, as it's known colloquially, that I'm just coming to that, funnily enough, in my next choice. Strangely, I am. But getting over the gates one night, because when you come out the pubs, and all the good ones tended to be up the other end of Jamaica Road, the Lilliput Hall and places like this. My first DJ job in the Lilliput Hall didn't go well. Anyway, so coming back, we'd all climb over the park gates at night and walk across. And we came out in a road called Hawkston Road at the other end, at the big gates. And we was climbing over, and there was a police car sitting there with a light on. Now, you know, a bunch of 16-year-olds getting over the gate, so what?
Mm.
And he got out and he came over and said, where you lot been? And we went, been at the pub. Why are you getting in the park? He said, shortcut. The park's shut. You're trespassing. He gave us all of this. And we kind of, all right, mate. And he said, take your pockets, mate. Just turn our pockets out. And we had tuppence halfpenny. And honestly, and it was me and Tom and Pete. There was only three of us. And he went, go on then, go. And as I turned around, he kicked me so hard up the ass. He's literally, the toe punt went so hard at the base of my spine. I'm sure the top of my spine bumped it at the top of my skull, and I had a little bump. And honestly, I lifted off the ground. I lifted off the ground, and I just kept walking. And I just, through clenched teeth, they said, but somehow, I said, you just kicked me right up the arse. Now, my two mates thought that was the funniest thing in the world. And that's the thing, you can take, you know, you can say, well, that's disgraceful, it's disgusting. I often talk about being caned at school and stuff, not in a, try to say, oh, it was all wonderful. I don't, thank God, you know, my kids have never been. I was caned a few times, but I said, but there's no denying, as atrocious as it is, and as reprehensible, and thank God we've turned our back on it, nothing was funnier than seeing your mate get caned. It was. I know it's a terrible thing, but this is the side you never hear. I saw mates of mine get caned. The first time I was ever caned was my great mate Lenny Byer. I used to sit next to Lenny. He lived on the Pepys Estate in Deptford, and I was in the second year or something. And I used to do this routine on the stage about the absolute brilliant way that kids would eat sweets in class. The teacher would be up at the front looking to, say, Mr. Kistasamy doing geography, and he'd have his back to the class drawing some kind of isthmus on the board, blah, 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 blah. And kids, while focusing straight on the blackboard, could slide a hand into their pocket. And remember, the sweets would be wrapped like in proper wrapped sweets, and blah, 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 and they would keep their eyes intently on him while under the desk, they could unwrap these things very slowly, right? And then what you do, you unwrap it, you put it in one hand, and you do the cough and drop, if you forgive the phrase. You run your hand over your mouth while you go, and pop it in your mouth, and then you've got the sweet in your mouth. But kids become so attuned to the slightest crackle of a sweet wrapping paper, they can hear it, right?
Yeah.
So I was sitting in class now, my hands below the desk, and I just unwrapped this thing, and there's that kind of glazed look you can tell when another kid is thinking he's unwrapping a sweet under the table. Right? So I did this, and I heard, Iger. And I'm just Lenny, who's next one down. There's a kid here, but then there was Lenny there. Iger. His best mate calls me Iger. Iger. Give me sweet. No. Give me sweet. I said, no. We're both looking straight ahead. Blah, 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 you know. loom pits and all of this, blah, blah, blah. And get me swing. So I've dug in my pocket and under the table while still looking straight ahead, I've passed this kid and he's took it here again, still looking straight ahead, the hand over like a relay race. He's took that and he's looked at me and I've gone, I'm putting this in my mouth like this. And he put his hand up and said, sir, Baker's eating a sweet, sir. And I looked at him. And the teacher turned to me, what? I said, Baker's eating a sweet, sir. And he said, are you Baker? And I said, yes, sir. He said, come out here. And I had to walk up the aisle to the bin at the front of the class. And you can drop anything, a rainbow drop in a bin. It makes that noise if you've been caught with contraband. Dang, as I drop this, you know, whatever it was, into the hardball sweet, into the bin. Stick out your hand. He went, whack. And then this hand, whack. Go and sit down. And as I went back past Lenny, he just pulled the biggest face in the world and went, and you had to think, well, fair enough. And over the next couple of years, we would try to get each other caned. I won't carry on, but it was on the top of a bus, on top of the number 1 or 47 up to the top of Deptford High Street. And I said, Len, you've got your apron, because if you've got your apron, because as you know, in working class schools, the emphasis was on woodwork and metalwork. Mm-hmm. You wonder why, right? So we didn't do languages. We didn't do any sciences even. We really didn't. We really, really didn't.
Wow.
No, we never had that. We had a science laboratory, but we never hired a teacher. Never once did we do science. Never once did we do languages, but plenty of woodwork, metalwork and sport. Mm. Couldn't have loved it more, by the way. Couldn't I? I adored every single day I was at school. And Len, what, you got your apron? Because forgetting your apron was the number one crime. And so Lenny had a like those briefcases you used to have, even at our school, you had it, and he opened up and, yeah, I said, show us it a minute, I'll show you something. And he went, hey, I said, I'll show you something. And he said, well, I said, I'm going to show you something, right? It changes everything. And he handed me this rolled up apron. And as he handed it to me, he had already opened the window on the bus. We're sitting upstairs. I just threw it out the window. Right? And we only had one stop. The guy went, no. Right? It was hammering down, raining. No. And we got off. And, of course, I went straight in. And I said, so I don't mean Bart's got his ape. Got him caned for that. Now, there's more to this. But all I wanted to say was that things are now looked back and lamented. And sort of said, it wasn't that terrible. But people are quite durable, and we didn't think at the time we were terrible victims of and what we can do.
No.
Not like army life. You do look back and think, that was funny. That was a terrible thing to do.
Terrible.
But it was no more unusual than anything else. You know?
I remember at school, people wore caning as a badge of pride, really. The people who got caned the most.
You know, and there was incidents where I know teachers used to single out some of the better looking kids to take it on the buttocks. And we know that. Anyway, but that's something else.
Yeah,
that's
strange else. Teachers. And we had some very strange teachers.
Although there is that. But we had some. Is that your phone?
Yeah. What's going on? Nobody ever rings my home phone.
There it is. It's the school board asking why you're in a school.
I'll let it go.
You know what? How we know you and I are of a certain generation. You got a landline. I got a landline.
Yeah.
It's still going. Answer it. Could be a job.
I'm going to turn it off. Hang on.
Could be a job.
It's gone. They are the moment I moved.
It's your agent saying, Mike, where were you this morning? 2 years in Emmerdale. 2 years. Beautiful. Lovely role.
Please. Please. Danny, no. 2 years in Emmerdale. Give over.
I know. You get less for mugging old ladies. I know. Anyway, I'll be going as like yesterday, drifting into the whole corporal punishment thing there. And I don't want to make a case for it. I'm just saying the side you never hear is we didn't, like in the workhouse scenes in Oliver, all cower as one of our poor friends had to go up to the front. Mm. We used to think it was the funniest thing. Yeah. Couldn't wait to get in the playground sometimes. Did you hear? Hutchinson got six this morning. I know, and you go and see him, you go and laugh. I'm sorry, but that is a definite working class resilience. It's not like Lindsay Anderson's if all the time. So should we? The next one I've got.
Yes. Which I said Let's move on to item number three.
What have we done? We did the smell of E.T.
Absolutely. The ride in Florida at Universal Studios.
The smell of a ride in Florida.
Yeah.
And we've got the Book of Nonsense, which led on to absolutely everything else. And the other one is it's going to be Newport Court, 1972. Newport Court is a small alleyway, well, small road, very small street that leads between Charing Cross Road and Chinatown in Soho West End. So if you come out Leicester Square Tube, walk up Charing Cross Road, it's about the first on the left. Now it's as anodyne as anywhere else around there. Mm. You know, it's a pedestrianised zone and like everything else, it's coffee shops. I think there's a couple of haute couture places. It used to be the centre, the heartbeat, or secondhand records. In 1972, I've been asked a few times, you know, if you had a time machine, where would you go back to? And even though you flirt with 1666 to see the plague handover to the fire and various other things, it's always Newport Court, 1972. I used to finish school, and the number one bus, which I mentioned earlier, the number one bus used to run from Catford all the way into the West End to Marylebone, and it would go past my house. But if I stayed on it for another 15 minutes, you're in the West End. Mm. And it used to stop at Newport Court. And if I had, my dad used to get records out of the docks along with other things for years. He would bring home records they were exporting on the CBS labels. So I used to go over Petticoat Lane when I was 11 and 12 and sell them. And I had to bring half the money back to him and the rest I'd spend on records. That's how my absolute lifelong addiction started with vinyl. Mm. And you catch me at the moment at a strange time. As you can see behind me, there's towering shelves and it goes off in that direction. I'm in the process of getting rid of them all.
No.
Yeah. My record collection, which is quite famous. I think it had to do with turning 65 and all this useless beauty. Mm. And my son collects records and he's taken what he wants out of this. But I don't know. People say, oh, you can't, you won't. I don't play them much anymore. The days when mates used to come round, we go, and they'd all say, oh, I used to have this. And there's virtually every record released in the 1970s here. Some are worth a great deal of money.
But as you said, you're not a sentimental man.
No. No, and I just think, you know what, I'm 65, Wendy's 67, and I'm not certainly on my last legs or anything like it, but equally, I've always thought life should have a third act. I've been saying this for ages, and when I tried to retire at 60, I probably should have done, but the tour's started, and as I say, June the 22nd next year, that'll be it, because you've got to have a third act, you know, you can't just let things dribble away, and one of them would be, if I had to sell these records for tax reasons or whatever it is, or you was skint, that would be heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But to sell them when Wendy and I are, you know, sitting on a beach in Bermuda and I think, yep, my 10 years after I'm going to pay for this, that seems a life well spent. So I'm in touch with a couple of auction houses to do that. But it all began when my dad getting records out the docks. You could knock these out for us, boy. He had a girdle on made of vinyl when he came in. He'd open his coat and there'd be all these records stuck around his waist. You know, people talk about dockers walking out with stuff, which was absolutely true. They did. They levied a certain export tax on everything. And our house would be full of everything from little noddy dogs for the back of the car to...
Yeah. You're no Jimmy Mulville. You know Jimmy.
No, of course, yeah.
Yeah. Jimmy told me a story about his dad working on the docks up in Liverpool and saying there was a bloke who every night would come out with a wheelbarrow with a tarpaulin over it. And they would say, oi, oi, oi. And they'd stop and they'd pull the tarpaulin back and there was nothing there. And just every night he'd be coming out this, and they'd say, we know he's nicking something. What's he nicking? He was nicking wheelbarrows.
That's perfect. We did the one where Berlin and said, there's a ton of Docker stories. Some apocryphal, not all. But my old man used to bring home the records. Just before we leave that, they were exporting shoes through where he used to work. He worked in the Millwall docks and ended up down at Tilbury, but most of his life was in the West India or the Millwall docks. Mm. And they were exporting shoes. And in the end, they were losing so many shoes that they started exporting the right shoe out of London and the left shoes out of Hull. That's absolutely true. But Dockers used to get in touch and they'd meet up halfway down the motorway and say, what's that? Was it like Italian brogue? 9, give us one. That's right. That's one pair. They would meet up along the motorway. All of that. So records. And my brother had records, but I had about, when I was about 13, I must have had about 50 records, because all I would do, my old man was very good with, I never had pocket money. Do you want that boy? I'd go on. If he'd done well at the races and stuff, certainly.
Yeah.
But 3 times a week, I would go on my own to Newport Court. And I picked 1972 because that's peak time, I think, for me selling records, the year I left school. But in that first part, I know I'd get the number one bus. And in my mind, it's always kind of getting dark at about 4 o'clock, 4:15. And I'd go all the way up there and I'd get off. And Newport Court, this little tiny conduit into Chinatown, had about 12 shops, but they were all tumbled down. And at least 7 of those were secondhand record shops, because they were on the edge of where all the record companies were. And as I later found out, the NME journalists used to fund their drinking habits by going around record companies, and saying, can I look in the cupboard, which meant all their releases. You take out handfuls of them, go straight down to cheapo in Berwick Market and sell them for cash and go into the pub.
Yeah.
I did that all the time at the NME. But at this age, I would take 4 or 5 albums my dad had got, or I'd bought that I didn't like anymore, all the way to Newport Court, and spend a good hour and a half. I say to my mum, I'll be late in between, mum. I'm going up the West End. And I would just, and I would smell the ones that you had to go downstairs to. There was a shop that sold kind of hippie clothing. There are lots of, I can see loads of the scarves hanging down now, and it had patchouli burning over here. But there was a stairway at the back. And you go down this stairway that, like, you had to hand up, it was virtually vertical into the basement, where there was just this old head, bearded head sitting there, was surrounded by boxes and boxes of records. And he knew me. Oh, hello, what you got? And I'd say, these. And he'd go, well, I can give you £4 cash for these, or you can take £7 in exchange, always exchange. And records were about £1 each.
Yeah.
And I would just pore over everyone, take them out, reading the back, other old heads around me, my shoulder. And that, to me, is bliss. That's Eden for me. And there was about 4 or 5 others down that way as well. And they sold bootleg records, the illegal bootleg records. And then I would get the bus all the way home. If I didn't go there, I would go to Trident Studios to try to see David Bowie, right?
Yeah.
Because I knew he recorded in Trident Studios. And if Bernard Sibley came with me, we were both very early adopters of David Bowie. And just around the man who sold the worldish time, just hunky-dory time. So he was an early adopter of him. So that's 71. And we knew Trident Studios. So the number one bus was equally handy for that. So we'd get off and stand outside Trident Studios. Now, in the playground, I was known amongst all for like in Way Out Music. There's a few of us, me and Bernard and stuff. And sometimes they would say, "Oi, Baker, who's that weirdo you like?" That'll be David Bowie, right? And I say, because that doesn't narrow it down. What weirdo?
They're all pretty weird, yeah.
The one where's the dress or whatever it was. I had and still have the original Man Who Sold the World, bought in Newport Court. Hand to God, swear to God, £1.50 that cost, which was expensive. Anyway, there was that weirdo. And so we just saw him. He was over the road. He was right outside the chip shop. All right, lads, thank you very much indeed. About a week later, they'd say, "Baker, you missed him again. He was with another load of weirdos. They was all smoking, sitting on the pavement, waiting for a bus." I said, "Oh, fantastic. Thank you very much. Run, you'll see him." "No, boys, I'm not running." Back to Trident Studios. Another week later, "Baker, you missed him again. He was in the baker shop. He was queuing up to get a roll." Okay. Now, 40 years later, a book came out called David Bowie, 47 to 74, The London Years, right? Mm. And it's the most exhaustive. It's a brilliant book, but it's the most exhaustive day by day. It's got every bus ticket you ever read. It shows that between 1969 and 1973, his rehearsal studios were 100 yards away from our school at the bottom of Blackheath Hill, beneath a chemist shop. yeah, Underhill Studios, and it really was him. And I never used to, and we used to get on the bus and stand outside Trident Studios while we were going away from where he actually was. And it, I didn't find that out until about 6 years ago. This book came out and it said, you know, August 1971, Bowie goes back to Underhill Studios to start rehearsals for what would become the Ziggy Stardust album, or whatever it is. And my mates used to say he's over there. Of course he was buying chips. In my mind, what would David Bowie be doing queuing up for a pasty? He obviously was, or waiting for the bus back to Beckenham where he lived.
Yeah.
And it was that. And I used to say, yeah, all right. I said, go around, you'll see him. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Me and Bernie just never saw him at Trident Studios, but outside our school on the other side of the road, that was where Bowie was.
Amazing.
So anyway, all of this is wrapped up in Newport Corp, which led on to the records, which led on to, you know, the punk fan, me getting the job in the record shop, which was in Dean Street then, and went to South Moulton Street after at One Stop Records, where within 2 weeks after leaving school, I'm knocking around with Elton John and Rod Stewart and that, because they were customers there. And so that's not just fortuitous. That's the most extraordinary thing.
Yeah.
Then the record shop, a very complicated and almost cosmic thing that happened in the record shop, led on to me being involved with punk rock.
Mm-hmm.
If you hear the chants that led on to that, that led on to the NME. While we was being punk rockers, because I can talk and stuff, television thought we were the ones. They couldn't get hold of the Sex Pistols, but they said, oh, they're kids who do that fanzine, which was done originally by Mark for about 4 issues in his bedroom. Then he left the bank, and then we would Xerox it and sell it around the West End and that things. And then we were selling like 20,000. We became, because we've got the jump on the NME and of all course. Of this, we became in ourselves quite well known. And one of them was Janet Street Porter, who came and did a whole thing. But they thought he's good, or she did. Mm-hmm. And Janet was the one who said, do you want to, I'm sitting, because the NME asked me to join, because I thought I'd be good for, you know, their kudos. We got that punk kid.
Yeah.
But I couldn't join. I was too much in awe of it. I said, I can't join it. Yeah, no. And Tony Parsons, who worked for the NME at the time, said, go on, join it. And he was on the road. I'll never forget, because Mark finished Sniffing Glue at number 12. He said, we've sold out. And I thought, no, we can keep doing this. No, Mark, he remained very true to the spirit of it. I desperately wanted to carry it on.
20,000 copies a week. You go, yes, please.
We didn't make a shilling, not a tanner.
Wow.
Not a tanner out of it. We did have £90 in what we passed for the corporate bank account. We were kind of owned at the time by Miles Copeland.
I did a television show years ago called The Rebellious Jukebox.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, Godley and Cream.
Yeah.
They were so off their faces the whole time. We filmed about 700 hours of material.
Oh.
It was brilliant fun.
Wow.
But I was doing a sketch with Meatloaf, and he said, hey, I got a great idea. What if I have this fuck off great big 10-gallon hat, big fucking thing? He said, I wear it, it'd be fucking brilliant. And everybody went, yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. We were all thinking, why? And Miles Copeland was at the back of the studio. He said, I'll get it. And we went, okay. And he came back 2 days later, and he'd bought it in Dallas. He'd been on Concorde.
No.
Flew over there and flew back.
For a cowboy hat.
A cowboy hat. By then we'd cut it.
I went on Concorde.
Did you?
I went on Concorde to New York, of course, to New York. And I went with Chris Evans, and we all went on Concorde. Wendy came, and out we went to New York. And within, as you know, you took off at, I think we took off like at 9 o'clock, and you're in New York at 10:30 their time, and you'd only been on the plane 2.5 hours. It's just
incredible.
You know, it's one of the great inventions. It was just extraordinary. Anyway, we was in a hotel down in Mercer Street, and we came out there, and on the other side of the road, as we came out the hotel, was Damon Hill, the motor racing driver. Now, I've got a connection with him through my brother-in-law, who knows him, and Chris was there, and he kind of looked over and saw Chris and me, and we crossed over, and he was doing David Letterman's show. And he said, what are you doing? I said, we've only just got into town. And he said, yeah. I said, we've come, if you don't mind, on Concorde. I said, you've been on Concorde, Damon? He went, no. I said, oh, I said, honestly, I said, you know, on a plane, you can never feel like the speed. I said, as soon as we got over the channel, they've got this thing at the front, this display showing 1 mile an hour, and you jump to the speed of sound. I said, and you literally feel it, and it pushes you back in the chair. I said, and you've got this kind of... And my wife nudged me. She went, you're telling Damon Hill what it's like to accelerate then.
Can you imagine such a thing, Damon?
Anyway, just tell me. So Sniffing Blue was because there was lots of corporate sniffing, and we wouldn't take any ads at first. And when it did, Mark said, "That's it. We've sold out. We mustn't do this." And he closed it down, which is fine. Mm. But I thought, what am I going to do next? And I was going to see Blondie and Television for Sniffing Blue for the last issue in a van with a few other journalists, put quotation marks around it. And one was Tony Parsons, the NME. He said, "What are you going to do when it comes?" I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Why don't you come and write for the NME?" And I said, that to me was like having my bluff called.
Yeah.
I said, "I'll be reading the NME." It was, you know, that was it for me. I knew the writers' names. I thought I knew what they lived like. And, you know, going to New York every week to do bands and all that. No. He said, "Well, I'll tell you what, we need a receptionist." And that's how I started. I said, "What?" He said, "We get a lot of nutcases come up the NME, looking for, you know, Freddie Mercury and that." And and he said, "We always have a male receptionist. Do you want?" And that's how I started at the NME, you see. And then after like 6 months, I was spending more time out on the road with bands, and the two women I worked with, I had to say, "I'd better join the staff." And I did. Now, I joined the NME, and then Janet Shreveport rings up, remembering me from the punk rock thing, said, "I'm starting a new youth program called 20th Century Box. Do you want to do it?" And I said, "I'm sitting in the NME." I said, "Yeah, all right." I said, "What do you want me to say on it?" She went, "No, we want you to do it. We want you to front it." Now, Mike,
it's crazy world.
When I said earlier on, you know, this actual serendipitous path, and people say, "Oh, he rang me up and said, "Do you want to do telly?" And that's how I got into television. Then she produced the two series of that. That finished. That was going to go nowhere. I'm in the bar at the end of its tenure because I'm nothing if not clubbable, and sitting with a load of people. And Janet was doing her nut. She was going crazy because under contract, she had to do what they told her. She was making this terrible series. I've got to go out and mix with the fucking public. I hate the public. Janet's going, you know, what is it? And it was this show called The 6 O'Clock Show, which was starting in a month's time, January 8th, 1982. And I'd left the NME. I had no idea what I was going to do next. And I said, it's got to be funny stories about London. I don't know. It's going to be terrible. They're going to make me into restaurants. And she was doing that. And I said, "Here's a story for you. All the pubs around Bermondsey are closing down. They're opening up as wine bars." And they, "What?" I said, "Honestly, there's this pub called the Coach and Horses. It's now open as Feathers." I said, "And people go in and they sell these different coloured drinks." And the producer was sitting at the table. Said, "How the locals were?" I said, "Oh, it's funny." And I said, "But the old people, they don't know what to make of it."
No.
2 weeks later, he rings up. Said, "That story, I floated around. Everyone loves it. Do you want to do it?" That was the very first 6 O'Clock Show, the very first one.
Yeah.
And I said, "Yeah." And I was on that for 6 years. So there you are.
Yes, I know.
There you are. I've never had a CV. I didn't have an agent the first 8 years I was in telly. But all of that, I think, comes from Newport Court 1972, where I just, as near as a bohemian lifestyle as I could manage, I would bring home these extraordinary records by most of them not very good, but they're all now worth thousands.
Because they sold so few.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they are antiques.
Mm.
And as you know, they sell for thousands.
Yeah.
A group called Leaf Hound, which I don't even remember them, £5,000, £7,000.
Yeah.
So my old men would bring home albums and I would take them over Petticoat Lane. Two trains that took to get to Petticoat Lane, Surrey Docks, which I can't call Surrey Keys, Surrey Docks to Whitechapel, Whitechapel to Aldgate East. I'm 11, you know, but I used to get Sunday morning out, I'd go, big old pile of records in a bag, and the stallholders got to know me. "What you got this week, boy, you know? Where'd you get these?" I said, "My dad's in the docks." They didn't want, "Okay, got it. All right, no problem." And I used to say, to keep after money, they'd give me like 50 pence, maybe a pound each for them. They'd sell it £1.50. And I used to go home with another bag of records. And my old man said, "You go, if I don't understand you, come back with more records and I'll send you out with it." But as long as he got his whack, he didn't care. Anyway, he's bringing home these records. And everything's good. I can look around now and think, what we got at the docks? Oh, CBS, so Santana albums, Leonard Cohen albums, Blood, Sweat and Tears. I remember that coming out of the docks, Decca albums, all that. And those are the big labels. One day he comes home, he's got this box of 25 records by a group called The Human Beast, right? Exactly. So you shook your head, I shake my head.
Yeah.
The Human Beast. And they wanted to be, they are almost like the Brian Pern TV series, but The Human Beast track by The Human Beast was all for the first side. Yeah. And it used to be, and then this voice would go, "The Human Beast has shed its second skin," right? And then, and it would riff. And even I knew it was no good. And it became a byword amongst my mates, The Human Beast. It was just a human beast anytime it wasn't any good. Anyway, I took these over the lane and they said, "What's this?" And I said, "Human Beast. Who are they?" I said, I don't know. Just give us two of that, you know, and so they wouldn't take it. And so I brought about 15 of them home out of a box of 25.
Yeah.
And I put them under my bed. And next week when I went back, I said, I ain't selling, take that back, which was so in the end, I only shifted about five human beasts. One day, where my flats were in Debenham Road, the other side literally used to be a bomb site. On the other side of Debenham Road, literally on a bomb site. And we was over there, as you did, hanging around on bomb sites, making fires, throwing things into it to see if they blew up, like light bulbs and batteries. Mm-hmm. And my mate Tom had an air gun, a Winchester replica air gun. And we used to, you know, put up cages out of Fiesta or whatever we found, or, you know, tin cans or whatever, and fire the old slugs at it. Bang, you know. One way, I said, I know what I got. So I went upstairs under the bed. There's the 20 copies of the human beast. Yep, I just brought them back. I propped it up against the corrugated, well, actually asbestos corrugated wall at one side. We had to go back 25 paces, see if we could get the nearest to the hole in the middle.
Very good.
We did.
Great game.
Eventually, like clay pigeon, we were throwing them up in the air. No, missed it, so-and-so. The last copy on eBay of the human beast sold for £2,700. This is an absolutely true story. And if you read any articles about it, it's now a much prized, obscure British psych album from 1970. Not many copies out there. I know why. We shot the hell out of a button. And I don't tell that as a, for instance, no, that is a true story.
You created that shortage.
Exactly. Yes. Me and my mates will get together and still, because you know that shorthand never leaves you. Mm. We'll be in a pub, some terrible record comes on. They'll go, oh, yeah, human beast. That's a shorthand for a terrible record. And when I tell them that story, they go, was that the human beast? That was the human beast on Decca. So I'm going to ask for the essence of Newport Court, mm-hmm. 1972, because the world was never as young for me as that. That was independence as well, as to go up there on my own.
Lovely.
And it became all this useless beauty you see me surrounded by now. So I've never really sold records, not much, when we went to America once, but this has been... this is a life's work. Mm. So Newport Court will be number three.
Yeah, I'm not surprised you cherish it.
Yeah.
I should put a slight whiff of Chinese food floating down.
Yeah, but do you know what? I never went to that end of it. I never walked up Gerrard Street at all. It was only when somebody said, oh, the one by Chinatown. I was like, is it? Because once you went past halfway, it was just hairdressers and stuff. It's only a short street. All the record shops are next to each other. Bang, 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 bang. I don't know. What hell, mate, they're living out of the record companies, because even the staff of the record companies will come down, offload stuff there. And there was every available space was taken up with boxes of records. But that lost London, which is lost now, because it's half a century ago now. Incredible, half a century ago.
I took my grandkids to London the other week. We went to the London Transport Museum, and then they said, where should we eat? I said, I know exactly the place. And I led them off to a little alleyway, and I went down it, and the place had gone.
Course.
Just one of those proper cafes, you know, where you go in and you can eat anything.
I went out Saturday before last with my daughter. She bought us tickets for me birthday to see a show, and then I got COVID and then we couldn't go, and now so it's rearranged for the other Sunday. And we went to this great restaurant in brand new. I'd never heard of it, but it's very good Italian-American restaurant in Covent Garden. And even saying to her, you know, this piano, I said, it was an actual market with lorries. I said, nobody come around. It was too industrial, you know, all of that. And we went there, and then we had an hour before the matinee was going to, a matinee started. And I said, I'm going to want to show you something. I don't know if you know about it, right? So we started cutting through from Covent Garden over St. Martin's Lane and around them little back streets. But there's actual houses, still two up, two down houses around between there.
Yeah.
And odd little shops that sell buttons and things. And she said, I didn't know you could. I said, it's higgledy-piggledy. I said, I'm so happy it's here, but let's see if this is still here. And you cross, eventually come out into Shaftesbury Avenue, and you cross over and there's that cinema. And then there's a little tiny road up the side of there that leads to Holborn Church. A little tiny, up the road. You go up the side of that. She went, where are we going? And I said, I was on a wild goose chase, or the old man's imagining it. And as you go up there, there is a walled garden, a park, basically.
Right.
Because there's council flats around the back of that, and they're still there. They were built in the 70s. And they maintain this little tiny park. Mm. And you walk in there past almost like Mary Poppins' wrought iron gates. And there's a sign saying, please don't pick the fruit and vegetables. They're ours and we cultivate them for distribution amongst the... And it is like this magic secret garden set between Shaftesbury Avenue and Oxford Street. And it's there. And my daughter, it was a great thing, because she went, oh my God, she knows the West End world. She went, I'm never going to find this again. It's not going to be here. I said, it's always been here. Yeah. It's one of the few things that I retain. I mean, I knew the West End like the back of my hand by the age of 13. Mm-hmm. I knew every single bit of it, mainly because I'd trawl around the record shops. When Virgin Records used to be up above Shelley's Shoe Shop on Oxford Street, that was Virgin Records. Yeah. I met Richard Branson years later, and we was on a plane once, believe it or not, when Chris Evans bought Virgin Radio from him.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was on a British Airways plane, and he had to be smuggled on it. Chris said, I'll do the deal with you, but I'm flying. We were going off to New York to do John Cleese. That's another story. We missed him. We got drunk and missed him. We're doing it with TFI Friday. Anyway, we did. There's another part three. Anyway, so, and the deal to sell Virgin Radio was done on a British Airways plane with Deep Incognito Richard Branson on board.
Oh, how fantastic.
Because that had to be done that day. And this Dutch consortium were going to buy it. But he liked Chris. He said, I'd rather sell it to a Maverick. But Chris said, I'm getting on a plane in a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. I said, well, is it one of mine? He said, no. I said, I used to buy bootlegs from you. He went, we never sold bootlegs. I said, Richard, when you was above, he said, we didn't. I'll put mine up. I wouldn't have had that. I said, Richard, you were notorious at Virgin Records, up the stairs and through the shoe shop. He's got a curtain at the back with a cardboard sign saying Virgin Records upstairs. And you went upstairs, and just like these places I've been describing, it was hippies schlumped out on beanbags, yeah. You know, and it was Virgin Records. They did mainly mail order, but they had this little shop there. And I said, on the wall, H-Bomb, Deep Purple, Wooden Nickel, Crosby, Stills and Nash, all these illegal albums. He said, well, not while I was there. And I looked at him and I believed him. I think when he went, I don't think he served me on the counter much, the staff took them all down again. But that's where I used to buy my bootlegs at Virgin. So that is the extent of how well, at 13, I knew the CD-ish underbelly of the West End.
Yeah.
And all of that is summed up by being Newport Court 1972.
Fantastic. Do you know, when you said Newport Court, right at the beginning, I've just finished filming playing a judge in the courtroom at Newport.
Oh, Newport Court, of course. Well, how about that? There's another little cosmic connection in a Newport Court.
In the Newport Court.
How did you?
Oh, guilty.
Was he?
Sent him down, yeah.
I did. If I start that story, we're literally going to be in part three. And we should let these people
get on with their lives. Let's move on to number four. So you've got one more thing you want to keep and one you'd like to put in there because you want to forget it. Okay, anyone need the loo? Well, this is your chance. And if you don't need to spend a penny, but you can spare one, you can join our Acast Plus subscription, where you'll get all episodes ad-free. Coming soon. In the meantime, we'll be back straight after these adverts. Right. Oh, no, someone's in there. Come on! I'm bursting!
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for waiting. Right, we've all washed our hands, obviously, so let's return to Danny Baker and find out his final choices for the time capsule.
Number four, the fourth thing that I would like in my time capsule to be something that I would cherish and want to be remembered by is doing nothing. I did think about this. I thought, what do I like more than anything? As I said to you yesterday, you know, I hope with great respect, an hour before we recorded this, I thought, oh, I've got to do a thing with Mike in an hour. Why do I agree to this? I'm sitting here, as I say, you know, idly doing nothing, which is, I just the song, busy doing nothing, working the whole day through, trying to find lots of things not to do. Even though people say, oh, come on, 45 years, you've been in public guy, you've been working all the time. So I was on all four channels in one night during that regrettable period until the public got sick of the sight of me when I was on everything. And by the way, this is the house that Daz built. But if I'm absolutely honest, what gives me more pleasure? Doing nothing. I suspect I've spent a lifetime doing that. I've never attended any meeting about anything I've ever done before, during or after a show. Never. You know, I've never made connections within the BBC. Mm-hmm. I'm very clubbable, as you know, and I've got a lot of friends kind of in showbiz, but were self-contained here. And it was always very eccentric. But at the heart of it was a total lack of commitment and of work ethic bordering on inertia, always. And the thing that suits that best is your show business.
Yeah.
Well, no, don't put it the other way. Not the acting side of it, the television and presenting side of it. Mm-hmm. Radio comes very easy to me, so that was a boon. Telly's no sweat at all. I don't do anything particularly memorable. But doing 40 years of that, I would constitute doing nothing, even if that sounds like a bit smug. But the idea of doing nothing, and I'm going to lunch after this with my old producer from Five Live, I haven't seen for a while, whose life I think I changed a little bit. If Claire's listening, I hope you don't mind me saying, I think she would agree. She was very corporate. She had her own production company with, working, selling to the BBC. Mm-hmm. Work was everything to her. And in the 5 years we worked together, suddenly she became quite indolent. And when I got fired, she left as well, closed her company, left, and spent the rest of the time going around the world. And I get postcards from all over the world, all over, literally. She said, look where I am, look where I am.
Oh, brilliant. Well, if you're responsible for that, then you've done well.
And a month ago, she sent a photo and a chap who's Swiss, she met quite late on. She said, look where I am today. And I was at Marylebone Registry Office and she looked marvellous and has just got married.
Oh, how lovely.
Yeah, me and Claire are very, very, I hope I was at least partially responsible for this wonderful third act, even though she's not as old as me.
I love the idea of this third act. You're really pulling me in at the moment.
Of course you should. The first act is, the rock and roll years, if you like, to the enemy. Then I went into telly and kicked my legs up and all of that for, 30 years. Now I was saying, me and when... Let's face it, we're in the mid to late 60s. Mm-hmm. The kids are all grown up and gone. We're living this rattling around this big old drum. So we'll sell this and this record collection's going. So I've got a pretty good cushion for the whole third act, and that's fine. When I go, I want people to say about me what they say about, anyone who's done well. Well, he sure went owing a lot of people money. That's all I want them to say. He went owing people a lot. No, I want this third act to be absolutely wonderful. Yeah. Literally going off into the sunset, literally doing that, mm-hmm. which is all we intend to do, me and Wim, because we're quite happy. Once the front door's shut, I've got nothing to do. And as I was saying, I'm meeting Claire in an hour in the West End, the most agreeable restaurant I always use. But I'll tell you the truth. I woke up this morning and I thought, okay, I've got to be doing part two. Oh, then I'm going to lunch and I'm sod it. Now, it's going to be lovely.
Yeah.
It's going to be lovely. Yeah. But the idea of having a diary, which I've never had, an agenda or, as I say, even a CV, frightens the life out of me. I'm very good for saying, which is probably why we haven't done this sooner, Dan, do you want to do this? So-and-so? When is it? Say this will be in March. When is it? It's in August. Yeah, I'll do that. It's August. But as we know, things don't roll around.
No.
They leap right out at you.
Yeah.
And the next thing saying, you haven't forgotten about that corporate on Monday. Oh, can you get us out of it? Can you get, oh, come on, there's a lot. Can you get us out of it? And so, again, unfortunately, to be able to do that, but I've always been like that. There's a great thing in Seinfeld when my sort of soulmate George says at one time, he's talking to Jerry, and Jerry says, I've got to go out because I've got a meeting with a guy. And he went, you got to meet him with someone? He says, yeah, I'm meeting this guy to talk about something. He goes, will he show up? He went, well, I hope he'll show up. Went, no, that's not what I think. I've never had a meeting or an appointment where I wanted the other person to show up. I am totally at home with that, even with friends.
You're totally right. I do wake up every day. I do have a diary. I look at it and I'm annoyed if there are things in it.
Things to do.
Yeah.
Is there any sweeter phone call in the world? Then when you're getting ready to go out and do something, everyone goes, Dan, I'm so sorry. We're going to have to cancel today. I'm so sorry. And I'll make all the, you're joking. No, and really, my feet are doing a dance, my snoop. Yeah, we're going to have to schedule this. I'm so sorry. They're ringing, they're apologising. And even sweeter is to say, they are still going to pay you for today. That's the Bob Hoskins story in the Untouchable. You know that when he was signed up to do the Untouchable, $1.6 million, I think he was getting. And, it was, he had the 3 months blocked out and that. And then they called him up 2 months before he was going to start and said, Bob, you're sitting down. What? Look, Robert De Niro was originally cast for this, but he couldn't do it, but now he can. And he said, oh, all right. And he was looking forward to it, Brian De Palma and all that. He was looking forward to it. And he thought, oh, so where does that leave me? They said, well, they really want to go with De Niro. It doesn't affect, they're still going to pay you. And he said, and I thought, he got 1.6 for not doing it. That's the work we all want.
That's the career you want.
That's the career you want.
We don't want you to do this, but we're going to pay you.
We'll give you 1.6 million if you don't show up. I've done pretty well over the last 4 decades and plus, but that is still the sweetest. So my fourth thing would be if this is a box with four boxes within it. The fourth one you open, there's nothing in it. Or there would be. There'd be a diary for that year with absolutely no entries in it.
Completely empty.
That, to me, is the sweetest thing. When people, you know, people say to us, what are you working on at the moment? I'll say, oh, nothing. They go, well, I suppose in your game, it's like, I say, no, you don't understand. Did you hear the laughter in my voice as I said that?
Nothing. Nothing at all.
Absolutely nothing.
I'm completely free.
I've got no deadlines. I've written everything from the BAFTAs to the Comedy Awards before they descended into the mire. And as you know, that's the phone goes, and if you've got 3 projects going on. Hi, Danny, sorry, how are we doing on that? Can you give us anything by the end of the day? I thought, like, someone's choking me.
Yeah.
Absolutely choking me. So nothing would be the ideal for number 4 there.
Fantastic.
I hope that makes sense to people without sounding maniacal.
It does. It's going to be an empty box. Well, this is a prime example of me doing nothing, is that I have ideas and then do nothing about it. So that keeps me happy. You know, I've had a good idea. I could have done it.
I am tremendous with ideas. I've always been, and will tell you, I will come up with the greatest concepts. I'm very good in meetings. If like they call me to their, I don't want a meeting, but if they say, Dan, we were just talking about this, and I can always say, I'll tell you what's better. And they say, would you write that down for us? Mm-hmm. And I never do. It comes very easy because it would require some commitment.
You would have liked my idea I had years ago, which was a diary for very unimportant people. It was already filled in.
That is wonderful, Mike. That's a great idea. I've had mine... purloined plenty of times, and plenty of times. I stood on the radio when I used to ring up and read your teenage diaries.
Yeah.
Suddenly Radio 4 had a series on my teenage diaries. Okay, I'll take that. I used to do on the radio, tell us what you've never done, because my friend Danny Kelly's never worn a pair of jeans in his life. And people ring up and say, I've never been to a concert. We sent them to a concert. Some said, I've never used a vending machine. This sort of thing. You say, wow. Now on Radio 4, I've never seen Star Wars. I think that's into his 10th series now.
Yeah.
Where did these wacky young researchers
get their ideas from?
Equally, would I have done anything with that beyond knocking it out on the radio? No. Did they ever really want to make monkeys dressed as famous people plus fairground music? No, they didn't. Look how that ended for me.
Yes.
But there's you and I both joined at the hip in that. Maybe we'll get together after this and thrash out an idea.
There's a certain pride, I think, in having an idea and just going, well, I had that idea and I'll put it out into the world. If anybody wants to do something about it, off you go, because I can't be asked.
The best script, if I had, forgive me here, any kind of lost project, I was approached by, and at one time I was just about the highest paid. I was always, because my agent ring, I'd say, dude, I said, I really don't want to. But it's easy. I said, I really don't want to. And you know what that's like in the business?
Yeah.
They've come back, they've gone up, they've upped it to this. And they've, and honestly, only because, I wanted to do nothing. Mm. I really don't want to do it. Honestly, it'd take you 2 weeks. And I said, will it? They drag on, but they come back. And then they come back and you think, well, I've got to do this.
Yeah.
Well, I was approached by the Henson Company, the Muppet people, to do a thing, a new game show. They were reviving it. They couldn't call it the Muppets, though, because they'd sold that name to Disney.
Right.
I met with them. They gave me these sketches of about 40 new Muppets. And they pushed them over the desk, and these are the photographs. They were being made in Chicago. They say, you can look at them, see what personality, it's all on you. You can write this thing. It's a game show, and we want you to have fun with it. It was a blank sheet of paper.
Wow.
So I went home and I looked at these things, and I liked the idea of a host who's ended up on this show. So I wrote it in the voice of Alec Guinness. And the opening of it, I've run through as quick as possible. It was taking place like the old Muppets used to be in this theatre, which hosts this game show. And somehow this great old man of the theatre or broadcast has ended up fronting this madhouse.
Yeah.
And I remember the opening was applause. Thank you. I shall now try to live up to that most fulsome of encomiums. That was the opening line of it, right? Thank you, one and all. I shall now try to live up to that most fulsome of encomiums. And that's how he spoke. And I thought it was the best thing I'd ever written, but it turned into an absolute nightmare. And probably I didn't put enough effort into it. And eventually got let go from that. They paid us. It wasn't Bob Hoskins' money, but they paid us. And it eventually came to the screen, and it was called That Puppet Show, That Puppet Game Show. It went out. Right. The only thing that remained, one of the characters was called Mency, which is the name of my youngest daughter. Mm. But it was a shame because it was a really, it would have been a really terrific show. And as it came out, it went straight down the toilet, didn't even touch the sides.
No.
Which I took no pleasure in, Mike.
No, 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 you'd been paid.
I'd been paid, and also it looked like I might have been right. But that, of all the things I've ever done, that was, and the second series of Cradle to Grave, which circumstance, I'm afraid, overtook us.
Mm.
Now we've gone, but that was, that's the number one job. Number one was that, number two, The Jungle.
Yeah.
But seeing your teenage life recreated for television. it was the happiest show to be on.
I don't know,
nobody who was on that show doesn't say that was the best job they had.
Yeah.
It was wonderful. With the great Jeff Pope writing it alongside me. And I've known Jeff since the 6 o'clock show days. He joined as a researcher from the Hayes Gazette.
Mm-hmm.
So we've known each other all that time, you know. That was the number one job of my career. Absolutely, without doubt. We can, you know, look at the other end of it for as long as you like, but let's look up, not down. But that incredible ride, filming that in Manchester, and recreating Bermondsey 1973.
Ah, fantastic,
oh,
yeah.
That's all. Oh, what a gig. If I'd have known you then, we had a judge in it.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and I know how good your judges are.
With a slight twinkle.
But a slight twinkle. And you'd have come over to me saying, hey, I've only got two lines in it. Wouldn't it be better if I summed up at length?
I think I can make something of this, Dan.
I met William Mervyn when he was on Crown Court, and Bill told me.
You seem to know me well.
So, I'm very good friends with Gary Warren, who played Peter in The Railway Children, little boy.
Mm.
And there's someone who walked away from the business, tried to get him back for Cradle to Grave. I said, Gary, he lives in New York now, but he was living in England at the time, and we're very, very close. He used to listen to the show I used to do on BBC London. He's a massive music fan, and he used to call in, Gary, from Neasden.
Right.
He used to call in, and one week he just was talking about something or other, and he said, because I was an actor, you know, before, and he said, and I said, you was an actor? And I knew him, Gary. And I said, what was you in? He went, oh, don't. I said, well, come on, anything we might know. He went, I was in The Railway Children. I said, what was you? You're not Gary Warren. He went, yeah. And I said, wow. Man, a cat weasel and all that.
Yeah.
But by 15, he just walked away from it.
Mm.
He loaded, but he walked away from it. Anyway, and when I found out, you know, you wear your CV quite lightly, but if I was in The Railway Children or Cat Weasel, I'd walk around with billboards, with a sandwich board saying, yes, it's me from The Railway yes. Children. Right, shall we go on to the, what we'll get rid of?
Let's go on to the one thing you want to put in there you want to forget about.
Well, last night, we were all sitting outside, me and the kids, and the subject got on to mean people, people who are tight with money. And then the number one sin in our family was, and believe me, as I say, I mentioned I spent every time thinking, oh, it's all right for you, but it wasn't always all right. I used to get cabs when I was like 14. And people say, well, how do you have that money? Well, working at a record shop, I'm my father's son, and, you know, if somebody gave us 12 quid for a bunch of records, I'd ring up 10. But it's not all based on crumb. I've always been, and everyone in our family has always been. My old man said, no, mean bastard, mean. And when I was at the NME, I found out, forgive me, most middle-class people won't get around in and things mm-hmm. like that. Or this whole idea of planning for a rainy day, and never, ever since I can remember, has not been like that. My old man was always pay up and look big. You'd always, as I've mentioned before, you'd always be able to forage around. And we was hearing last night about someone who just tight people, you know. Oh, is it mine? Oh, sorry. What did you want? If you sit there, nothing irks me more than people who are close to a pound note. Close to a pound. I know a couple in this game, close to a pound
note. The detailed working out of a restaurant bill. It drives me mad. And a number of times I'll get this.
Well, me and you both, brother. Mm. And anyone will tell you in this game, even literally, you know, I've gone way over the overdraft. Because if you're sitting there, I've only got two or three other people in my life who you have to fight to pay a bill. It's not to look like the big time Charlie at the end or anything like that. It's just that it's how you do it. Everyone should have plenty of everything if you're in your company. And my nephew liked that phrase so much, he had it tattooed on his leg. Plenty of everything. And again, it's a difficult concept to understand, but unless you are, I suppose, word is, you know, naturally generous. But I don't say that in order to be. Everyone I knew growing up was like that.
Yeah.
You couldn't survive. When I joined the NME, it was a great shock to find out that mainly people who come from a few quid would sit at the table and let you buy round after round. And I would.
Mm-hmm.
I said, don't buy them. I said, I know they're like that. I'm not.
Yeah, yeah. when you're going in the flats, you go to people's houses, the first thing they say, you want a cup of tea, you want some toast?
Do you want something to eat?
You want a meal?
Or if somebody had it off on the horses, my mates, they'd walk into a pub and slap it on the counter and say, right, let's knock that out. You know, it was 30 quid, which you got your lot.
Yeah.
And you would. You'd knock it out. There's all, and in my life, there's always been one big bowl of it. The life is a tough old cat and you skin it any way you can. And people who are even cautious with it, I don't understand. I mean, when I was first offered a job on the 6 o'clock show after 20th Century Box, when I was sitting at that table there and they've got that job on the 6 o'clock show, I said, do you want to front this story? And it went over big. And that show, we didn't know it was going to be such a hit, but it ran 8 years. They offered me 750 quid a show. I had no agent, remember, right? I had to sit down with Greg Dyke, who was the editor of the show, and John Burt, executive. And I'm like a football player signing up for a club. He said, Danny, we'd love you to join the team properly. And I said, all right, because they'd already given us 500, this one in the Old Kent Road. And that had gone. This is only 6 days later. That had gone. And I sat down and they said, you ain't got an agent, have you? I'm doing Greg's voice here. I said, no. We went, well, you've got five for that, but, you know, we want to sign you up for at least a year. They said, that's 750. I said, and I'm thinking, well, every week, this is 1982. Is it not, no, I know it's vulgar because the British don't like talking about figures. I'll tell you. I said, yeah, absolutely. I said, oh, if we continue like that, we'll talk again. And I thought, hang on, we'll talk again. I said, I'm going to retire. I know, but I knocked that out. Like we used to shop at Heels and Liberty, and I met a bloke the other. How about this? I was on the tour in Northampton, and the Reverend Richard Coles, the great Reverend Richard Coles, said he wanted to come and see us. So Richard came, and he turned up with this other fellow who's now the not the Grand Moff Tarkin, but whatever the head of a university is, the rector of so and so of the university up that way, right? And he said, there was this fella there, in obviously well healed and very well spoken. He said, very much enjoyed it, Danny, thank you. I said, well, thank you very much indeed, your rectorship or whatever it was, you know. And Richard said, you two have met before. And I said, have we? And he went, I was just a student on my first job, he said. But I said, well, how? I said, well, on the 6 o'clock show. He went, no. He said, you used to live high up in a high-rise flats. And when we were first together, when I was first on the 6 o'clock show, still on the council, we lived on the 19th floor of a block called Mayhew House, which is just Hawkston Road, Raymouth Road. You know Raymouth Road? Mayhew House is that big tower block. There's three in there. So we lived in there. Lovely flats, absolutely lovely flats. You walked in, down into the front room, big windows looking out over the West End. You turned, went down some more stairs to the bedrooms, big windows looking out over the River Thames.
Yeah.
West End one on 19th floor, you can imagine. As you can probably imagine, these days they're being renovated for private use. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so... he said, you used to live on the top list. I said, yeah. He went, you bought a three-piece suite from Liberty's, didn't you? And I said, yeah. He said, I delivered that. Me and my friend, we'd never delivered to Bermondsey before. And when we went down that turning and looked at the block, I said, well, one of us is going to have to stay in the van because of the other stuff. But they did. They got it in the lift and they brought it all the way up.
My Uncle George lived in that block.
Did he?
Yeah.
Yeah, the beautiful Swedish design. Mm. People used to complain about them. Oh, these flats, you know, dude. They're beautiful flats.
Amazing, yeah. Big?
A huge flat. I mean, it wasn't the fucking... It wasn't the flats that pissed in the lifts, thank you very much. It was the people.
But I bet that he was delighted the lifts were working if you were on the 19th floor.
In that block particularly, as you know, people would press all the buttons and they got out. So you'd stop... Oh, that rotten bastard's pressed all the buttons. You'd stop at every floor. And the other thing that they would do is... And here's a word you ain't heard for ages, flob on the buttons. And so you'd, he's flobbed on the 19.
Flob.
And you'd have to get a bit of paper and just push the 19 with that. And that little terrible little window in the lift that give no light. They're reinforced with wire.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to be able to see through there. My mate once, he got a job as a milkman. Well, he was the other bloke on the float. And on about his third day, they were delivering to Mayhew House. It's this 24-story tower block in Bermondsey, everyone. And of course, the old sweat said to him, nah, I'll help you out with the crates. There's your list of what you've got to deliver where, right? He said, I'll wait in advance and no one nicks it, not on the floats, and no one nicks it. So people thought, oh no. You had about like 15 crates. So the lift come, only one working, of course. I've waited ages. And the bloke said to me, he said, now look, I'll give you a tip here. Get a matchstick, he said, and stick it in the open door button, and it holds it. So you don't have to keep, when you get out, if you don't have to wait again for the lift and take all the,
yeah.
What do you reckon happened? Of course, Pete said, okay, all right, thank you. He got up to about the seventh floor, didn't he? Stuck the thing in there. He's got, took one crate out, and he's done two red top here, one so and so there. And he's a, the matchstick has fallen out. He spent the next half hour running up and down the stairs trying to catch up with his own milk. By the time he found it, everyone had helped himself, even at that time. Anymore. He lost half of his load. He just did the matchstick fell out and up and down major house it went. Any rate, coming back to mean people, and I hope no offense to that, but I'd like to think that the anecdotal and any research you want to do on it say he's nuts. Mm. Not just me, I know loads of people like it, but I feel for people who are terrified by money.
Yeah.
It's the tyranny of money. My old man used to call it that. Knock it out, boy, knock it out. You'll never get... And when I went to Hawaii, as I did in the first, at the end of the first series, it's a clock show, we had nothing. If you read the first book, you'll find out, and there's the actual letters from the bank manager. He was a wonderful, wonderful man. His name is Mervyn, and he was a Holborn. And I never had a bank account. I'd open one, so London would be paying me. They weren't going to give me cash, which was a great shock to me. And Mervyn used to live vicariously through me. He loved the fact that I was always going off on holidays or pipelining outlandish stuff and never had any money in account and didn't respond to the usual letters. I didn't.
No.
So he started writing me the most extraordinary letters in character. He would write as a mafia boss. He would write as Queen Elizabeth. I take it you are back from the Indies. I wonder if you might look at... And he used to write these letters.
Wow.
He used to let me get away with murder. Right? One he wrote a letter from Barclays Bank, edged in black, right? He edged the whole letter in black and he addressed it to Wendy. Dear Wendy, I know I'm probably the last person you want to hear from at the moment, but I couldn't let this pass because Danny wasn't just a client. He was a very good friend of mine and we had many, many laughs. Anything you need during this difficult period, please don't hesitate to get in touch. I know we're down the list, but I'm looking at the account and it's, please don't even think about it until it's my greatest condolences. P.S. I'm addressing you like this because no money has gone in for 2 months and I'm assuming he's dead. And people thought I was making this up.
Oh,
and some of the letters in the book. And when I did the one show to promote Saint about 5 years ago, they found him and he'd retired now. He's much older. And he came out, Mervyn, and he said, I used to sit in an office all day dealing with like a bank manager, he said, like the old time bank managers, you know.
Mm.
He said, and it was a parade of misery. And I'd get letters from, you know, Paris and all this. I just sent you saying, you know, unless we're paid by Tuesday, we're going to have to take leave. I did. I used to take family. And he just thought, after a while, I just thought, I used to get myself a sandwich and I'd make these letters up. And he said, it became a really fun part of my week.
How lovely.
Now, what are the chances of getting a bloke like that?
No. But, I mean, you say that, but you seem to attract that sort of world around you.
Well,
I think if you behave a certain way, that world will create itself.
Well, I hope so. And I hope it don't seem just, you know, annoyingly ebullient.
No. My dad was famous for being tight.
Was he?
Everybody said he was really tight. And so I know exactly what you mean. He would go to any length not to buy a round, but it's because it was funny.
Yeah.
If he caught a moth, he'd put it in his wallet.
Oh, what did he do?
And so he opened it and go, hang on, what's this doing in there? So he played the game. But when he died, a great horde of women from streets around Tooley Street came to his funeral.
Oh.
And they all said, oh, Harry used to come to, I used to drop in on a Wednesday afternoon and always made sure I was all right. He was basically looking after a great bunch of old women who'd known his mum. And he never mentioned it.
That's beautiful. That's lovely.
Yeah,
oh, my, that's lovely. Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
In 83, even though I've been paying his fortune, right, we had nothing, but I told Mervyn I was going to Hawaii, and we did. We went to Hawaii. Right? Neither of us said, when we're going to Hawaii? She went, I said, don't worry. And I said to Mervyn, look, Mervyn, you know I've got another series coming up. Why, that film script I wrote, Hollywood's Begging for Us, I said, it's rather like, I don't know if you know Woodhouse's Euchridge. I didn't know it at the time, but I was like, oh, Euchridge. Why, you're coming around here with piffling stories about thousands of pounds? Why, but the prospects are huge, old horse. Come on, and we did. And I always thought, you know what, if we come back and they say we don't want you with this series, I'm no further down the road than I was when I left school.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I'm going to be 88 and on my deathbed and say, really wish me and Wendy hadn't gone to Hawaii in 1983. No, can't. And knock it out. Knock it. I'm Viv Nicholson. Spend.
Wonderful.
And for people who don't understand, it's a terrific way to live.
Yeah, I bet it is.
Can sometimes make you gasp. And even to this, I've never had a savings account and I'm overdrawn as I speak to you now.
Mm-hmm.
Promise you. Absolute promise you. But does it worry us? Not in the slightest. It's a touch of Micawber as well. Something will turn up.
Yeah.
My record collection, for a start.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it's the thing I would put into a box to banish from the world, from my own experience of the world, mm-hmm. are mean people.
That's in there, but it's locked.
Exactly. And they will come and visit me with chains around them. They don't live as I live.
Well, if you're doing Dickens, then you're definitely not Ebenezer, but you remind me so much of Mrs. Fizzywig.
Oh, Fizzywig.
Fizzywig. There's a line about her that I always think, what a way to be, what a way to live. It says, she entered the room, one huge, substantial smile.
There you go. Well, bless you for that. You know, I'd like to think it was entirely down to philosophy and not dumb luck.
Yeah.
But that's exactly how it's been. But as I said right at the top of this, I've been stuck with this ever since we moved to it. And I thought, you moved here because I was born? What, oh? Hand me those 7-league boots. So that's how it's been, and that's how it remains.
Fantastic. Danny, have a fantastic lunch.
Well, Mike, thank you very much for asking me to do this, and thank you, everyone, if you've stuck through this, I think, 3 hours or something. But, yes, I'm now going to have lunch, and just watch me pick up that tab. Watch me pick up the bill.
Absolutely.
The last time I went... I went with a very good friend of mine who's one of the best script writers in Britain. And we'd always said we were going to meet up after COVID. So I met up with Simon and we went to the same place where I'm going now. And we sat down in there at 1 o'clock. And this is the kind of place it is as well. We stood up again at 9:15.
Oh, gorgeous.
We went through lunch, we went through the afternoon, and we went through dinner.
Yes.
We were going to pack it in about 4 o'clock, but I then said, you know what I enjoy? Nobody else does. But just to finish, I do like a grappa. He called me sister and laced daisies into my hair and said, then grappa it is. I don't think this is going to be quite as long, but it might be.
You never know.
It's called Vasco and Piero's Pavilion.
I'm going to go.
It's full of people who once put on splendid productions with Binky Beaumont. And it's yeah. And they don't hurry you up at all.
I shall take you there and we'll both fight to pay the bill.
I'll do that. I would love to do that. No, yeah. You've got no chance. If I'm with someone I know is going to do that, I do the old, where are the toilets here? And get hold of the motion. I take my card now. Anyway, sorry, everyone. That'll do us.
Danny, I'll leave you in peace. Wait. God bless you, mate. How lovely to talk to you.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks for everyone.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Danny Baker. Thank you for listening and supporting this podcast. You can also help us by subscribing to this podcast and by rating or reviewing it. Do follow me and My Time Capsule on Twitter, Instagram or Facebook, where we're happy to chat and answer questions. You can listen to the theme tune by Pass the Peas Music on Spotify, whenever you want. This was a cast-off production for the podcast provider Acast. It was skillfully produced by John Fenton Stevens. Right, thank you for staying with us through these 2 marathon episodes. Then again, who wouldn't enjoy a marathon? I was watching the London Marathon yesterday, and you know what? I saw a man run by dressed as a chicken. And then a couple of seconds later, I saw someone run by dressed as an egg. I thought, this will be interesting. Till next time, bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.